A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
The strangest feeling in the world is typing your own email into a breach checker and watching it come back with a password you actually recognize. There's your address. There's the name of the street you lived on in 2014, and you didn't put it there. Somebody else did, and now it's sitting in a database you're allowed to look at but not touch.
And the service says, yes, we found you in three breaches. Here's what was exposed, but it won't let you download the actual file. You can see your own record, but you can't pull the whole dataset. Which feels almost rude until you think about what that dataset actually is.
Daniel sent us a whole thing about this. He's been poking around Dehashed, found his own information in multiple places, and got curious about what happens after. Not the breach itself, but the afterlife. What happens to the dataset once it's out? Are those records still in existence? How many people are holding copies? And the answer to that second question, as he puts it, is that nobody can really know. Once a breach has happened, the chain of custody is essentially unknowable.
Right. And he wants to understand why. What's the actual pipeline that makes it unknowable? He lays out three mechanisms. Automated downloading of breaches the moment they drop. Repackaging into larger files, combo lists, mega collections, and the sneakernet. Physically moving data between people who make a living peddling it. USB drives, external hard drives, sometimes printed material.
And the point he's circling is that all of this explains why the working assumption in security is that once information has been verifiably released in a public dataset, it's indefinitely compromised and in indefinite circulation. That's not paranoia. It's the rational response to how the pipeline actually works. And knowing a credential was breached is often the most actionable thing you can learn, even if you can never retrieve the data itself.
So let's trace the afterlife of a breach dataset, from the moment it drops to the moment it becomes permanent background noise. The first distinction that matters. Here's between the breach event and the breach dataset. The breach is a moment. Someone got in, exfiltrated records, and at some point those records got posted somewhere. That's the event. It happens once. The dataset is an object. It has a life cycle. It gets copied, traded, repackaged, re-released, sometimes for years.
The breach is the crime. The dataset is the loot, and loot circulates.
And that circulation is the afterlife Daniel's asking about. The period after the initial exposure when the data keeps moving. The original company may have disclosed the breach, forced password resets, sent the apology email, but the dataset doesn't care. It's out there living its own life.
And this is where Dehashed and similar services sit in a slightly awkward position. They can tell you what was exposed, your email, a password, maybe a phone number, an address. But they deliberately won't let you download the compromised data itself. Even your own record. You can't just pull the full file.
Because the moment they let you download the dataset, they stop being a monitoring service and become a stolen data library. A convenient repository of compromised credentials that anyone could browse. Attackers would love that. It'd turn a defensive tool into an offensive one overnight.
So the service answers one question very precisely. What was exposed? But it can't answer the question Daniel's actually asking. Where is that data now? And who's holding it?
And to understand why it can't answer that, we need to look at the three mechanisms he named. The first one is automated downloading, and this is the one that makes takedowns almost meaningless.
Walk me through the timeline on that.
A dataset gets posted to a forum, a paste site, a Telegram channel. It's a link, maybe a file. Within minutes, bots and scrapers have grabbed it. These aren't people sitting at keyboards. They're automated systems watching known distribution points. The moment something new appears, it's downloaded, mirrored, re-uploaded elsewhere.
So the original poster could delete the file 10 minutes later and it wouldn't matter.
It wouldn't matter at all. The copies are already out. This is why when Telegram or a forum admin takes down a leak, the leak is still everywhere. The takedown happened after the download. The horse didn't just leave the barn, it's already in three other barns.
And this is happening at machine speed now. The window between posting and first copy is measured in minutes, sometimes seconds.
The Cambridge Cybercrime Center did a whole study on this in the Telegram ecosystem. Telegram became a huge marketplace for stolen data because it's fast, it's semi-private, and channels can have thousands of members. Sellers post samples, buyers contact them, transactions happen in direct messages, and when a channel gets shut down, the community just migrates to a new channel. The data persists because the people persist.
So the platform is just the venue. Shut down the venue, and the market moves to another venue. The goods don't go away.
Right. And that's the key insight from the Cambridge work. Takedowns disrupt distribution temporarily. They don't eliminate the trade. The sellers have already built their reputations, their buyer lists, their contact networks. A new channel takes minutes to set up.
That's the first mechanism. Automated downloading means the data is copied before anyone can stop it. What's the second one?
Repackaging. This is where the provenance gets completely muddled. Someone takes a bunch of smaller breaches, combines them into one big file, and releases that as a new product. Sometimes they're called combolists, sometimes logs, sometimes mega collections.
So I take a 2014 breach from a retail site, a 2016 breach from a forum, a 2019 breach from a gaming platform, and I mash them all together.
And you release it as something new. Maybe you call it collection number 12, or the big bundle or whatever. Now a single credential, your email and password, might appear in dozens of different collections, each with a different name, a different claim source, a different seller.
Which means the question of where your data is becomes almost unanswerable. It's not in one place. It's been copied into 100 places, and each of those copies has been copied.
The 13 logs breach is a good example of how this works in practice. That was a collection that combined data from dozens of separate breaches into a single circulating file. It wasn't one company being breached, it was an aggregation. A greatest hits compilation of other people's breaches.
Like a mixtape of everyone else's worst day.
And that's exactly the problem. If your email shows up in 13 logs, you can't say, oh, that was the retail breach from 3 years ago. It might be, but it's been mixed with 30 other breaches and re-released under a new name. The provenance is gone.
So repackaging does two things. It makes the data more valuable as a product, because a bigger file is more attractive to buyers. And it destroys the chain of custody, because nobody can trace where any individual record came from.
And then there's the third mechanism, which Daniel called the infamous sneaker net, physically moving data between people.
Which sounds almost quaint. USB drives, external hard drives, like we're back in the early 2000s.
But it's still a real part of the trade. And it has a specific advantage. Digital transfers leave traces. Server logs, IP addresses, platform records. But if I hand you a USB drive in a parking lot, there's no log of that. No metadata. The data moved entirely offline.
So the sneaker net is slower, but it's harder to intercept. And it means that some copies of a breached data set exist only on physical media. A hard drive in someone's drawer. A USB stick in a shoebox.
And that's the part that makes the chain of custody truly unknowable. Because there's no way to count the copies that exist offline. You can't scan for them, you can't take them down. They're just there.
And some of them are printed. Daniel mentioned printed materials in his prompt. Which sounds absurd until you remember that a printed list of credentials is still a copy of the data. It's just a very slow copy.
The chain of custody problem is the thing all three mechanisms feed into. Once a dataset is copied even once, there's no way to know how many copies exist, who holds them, where they are, whether they're on a server in another country or a hard drive in a landfill.
Law enforcement can arrest a seller. They can seize a server. They can shut down a channel. But they can't uncopy the data. The copies that were made before the arrest are still out there. And the copies of those copies.
And that's the thing about digital information. Copying is lossless. Every copy is as good as the original. There's no degradation. A password from 2012 is just as useful in 2026 as it was the day it got breached, assuming someone reused it.
Which brings us to the implication side of this. If the chain of custody is unknowable, what does that mean for how we think about our own data?
The common assumption Daniel mentioned is the right one. Once information has been verifiably released in a public dataset, you treat it as indefinitely compromised and in indefinite circulation. Not because you know it's still out there, but because you can't know it isn't. The pipeline makes the default state compromised.
And that changes what a password reset actually means. If your password was in a breach, you change it. Good. But the old password doesn't disappear from the datasets. It's still there, still in the comblists, still being fed into credential stuffing tools.
The LinkedIn breach from 2012 is the canonical example. That was 160 million email and password combinations. Many of them hashed, but a lot of them got cracked. And those credentials were still being used in credential stuffing attacks a decade later.
Credential stuffing being the attack where you take a list of email and password pairs from one breach and try them on other sites. Banking sites, email providers, anything with a login form.
And it works because people reuse passwords. If you use the same password on LinkedIn in 2012 and your bank in 2020, the attacker doesn't need to breach your bank. They just try the LinkedIn password. If it works, they're in.
The old password is burned. Permanently. Even after you change it on the breach service, the old credential lives on in the datasets and keeps getting tried elsewhere.
This is why security professionals treat a breached password as permanently compromised. Not because the password still works on the original service, but because it's still in circulation, still being tested, still a key that might open a different door.
This is where Dehashed's limitation becomes clearer. It can tell you your email appeared in the LinkedIn breach. It can tell you what password was exposed, but it can't tell you how many copies of that breach exist. Who holds them? Whether your specific record has been repackaged into a newer collection with a different name.
The service answers what was exposed. It can't answer where is it now, because nobody can answer that. The moment the data got copied, the answer became unknowable.
There's a misconception that deleting your account or changing your password removes your data from circulation. It doesn't. The data set is independent of the service it came from. Your account on LinkedIn is gone, but the 2012 breach file still has your old email and password. Nothing you do on LinkedIn changes that file.
The data set has its own existence now. It's not connected to the company that lost it. It's not connected to you in any way you can control. It's just an artifact that exists and circulates.
If you're not in a recent breach, you might think your data isn't circulating. But old breaches and combo lists keep circulating for years. Your data might be in collections you've never heard of, with names that tell you nothing about where it came from.
That's the thing about the afterlife. It's long. Much longer than the news cycle around the breach itself. The breach makes headlines for a week. The dataset circulates for a decade.
Which brings us to the part of Daniel's prompt that I think is the actual insight. He says simply knowing that a credential has been breached is often the most actionable and relevant data point. And I think that's right. You don't need to retrieve the data to act on it.
Right. If Dehashed tells you your email and an old password were in a breach, you know what to do. Change that password everywhere you reused it. Turn on two-factor authentication. Maybe get a password manager so you stop reusing passwords in the first place.
You don't need the actual dataset for any of that. The knowledge is enough. The knowledge is the thing that changes your behavior.
That's the whole point of monitoring services. They're not giving you the data back. They're giving you the signal. The alert. The notification that says this credential is burned. Do something about it.
Which is why the refusal to let you download the data isn't just about liability. It's about what the service is for. A monitoring service tells you what happened. A stolen data library lets you browse everyone else's credentials. Those are different things.
The moment Dehashed let you download the full dataset, it became the second thing. Attackers would use it as a convenient source of fresh credentials. It'd be the opposite of a defensive tool.
The limitation isn't a flaw. It's the feature. The service gives you exactly what you need to act, and nothing more.
The thing you need to act is the knowledge that a credential is burned, not the credential itself. The credential itself is the problem. You don't want it back. You want to know it's out there so you can stop using it.
There's a strange inversion there. The most valuable thing a breach service can give you is information about a thing you'd rather not exist. The password is the problem. Knowing about the password is the solution.
The password itself keeps circulating whether you know about it or not, which is why the default assumption has to be that if it was breached, it's compromised forever. Not because every copy will be used, but because you can't know which copies exist and which ones won't be.
Let's talk about what this means for the idea of remediation. Companies talk about remediating a breach. They contain it. They patch the vulnerability. They notify customers. But what does remediation even mean for the data that's already out there?
For the data, remediation is impossible. You can't patch a copy. You can't contain a file that's already on 100 servers and a dozen USB drives. The data is out. The only thing you can remediate is your own exposure to it.
Which means changing passwords, monitoring accounts, freezing credit if necessary. Not because you can get the data back, but because you can make the data useless.
A breached password that's been changed everywhere is a dead credential. It's still in the datasets, still circulating, but it doesn't open anything anymore. That's the best possible outcome.
The afterlife of a breached dataset ends not with the data disappearing, but with the data becoming irrelevant. The copies are still out there. They just don't matter as much because the credentials don't work anymore.
Which is a strange kind of victory. You can't destroy the data. You can only devalue it.
The pipeline keeps running. New breaches get downloaded, repackaged, passed around on USB drives. The combo lists grow. The mega collections get bigger. The afterlife gets longer.
The automation makes it worse. The bots that download breaches are faster now. The repackaging tools are more sophisticated. The marketplaces are more efficient. The whole pipeline has industrialized.
Which means the assumption of indefinite compromise isn't going away. It's getting more true.
The backup tape was in a filing cabinet.
Wait, Hilbert, what backup tape?
The one from the medical practice. 1998. Somebody broke in through a window and took the tape. They left the computer, just took the tape. I spent a week figuring out what was on it.
You were doing data recovery in 98?
Office supply company. We sold toner and did data recovery on the side. Mostly floppy disks, sometimes a hard drive. This was a quarter-inch tape cartridge. The practice had been burglarized, and they needed to know what patient information was on the tape so they could send letters.
You reconstructed the patient roster from partial backups and paper records.
Took 6 days. I had a handwritten list by the end, names, addresses, insurance numbers, about 900 patients. The practice sent the letters, the tape never turned up.
That was it? The tape just vanished?
Nobody knows where it went. Could be in a landfill, could be in somebody's closet, could have been thrown out a car window. The police never found it. 28 years later, I still think about it every time I hear about a breach.
Because it's the physical copy, the one that never touched the internet, the one that could be anywhere.
The ones on servers, you can find those. Somebody's got a database, law enforcement seizes it, it's gone. But a tape cartridge in a shoebox in somebody's attic, nobody's ever going to find that. And it's still got 900 people's medical information on it.
The chain of custody isn't just unknowable because of copies. It's unknowable because some copies are physical objects that could be anywhere.
That's the part people forget. Not everything is on a server. Some of it's in a landfill. Some of it's in a drawer. Some of it's in a box that somebody forgot they had.
You kept the handwritten list, the reconstruction.
I kept it. I wasn't sure the practice would follow through on the notifications. Thought I might need to send the letters myself. They did follow through, but I never shredded the list.
You've been holding a copy of breach medical data for almost 30 years.
It's in a box in my flat. I look at it sometimes and think about the tape. I know I should shred it. But it feels like evidence. Like if the tape ever turns up, the list proves what was on it.
You're an unauthorized holder of breached data. You're part of the afterlife.
I suppose I am. 900 names in my handwriting. Never digitized. Never copied. Just sitting there. If something happened to me, nobody would even know it existed.
That's the thing about the sneaker net. It doesn't have to be malicious. Sometimes it's just somebody who kept the wrong piece of paper.
The tape had insurance numbers on it. Social security numbers. Medical histories. If it's in a landfill, it's probably degraded by now. But if it's in a closet, it's still readable. Quarter-inch tape holds up if it's stored properly.
You'd never know. The practice closed years ago, probably. The patients moved. The data is just dormant.
Dormant, but not dead. That's what I think about. It's not gone. It's just waiting. Somewhere.
The afterlife isn't just about servers and telegram channels. It's about the physical copies that nobody can count, because nobody knows they exist.
The physical copies are the ones that last. A server gets decommissioned. A database gets deleted. A tape in a shoebox just sits there for 30 years.
Which makes the chain of custody even more unknowable than we were saying. It's not just that you can't count the digital copies. It's that there are physical copies that were never counted in the first place.
The practice reported the burglary. They knew the tape was gone, but they never knew if it was copied before it was thrown away. And I never knew if the list I made was the only reconstruction. Somebody else could have made their own list.
Even the reconstruction has an unknown number of copies.
Everything has an unknown number of copies. That's what I learned in 98. Once it's on paper, it's out. Once it's on tape, it's out. Once it's in somebody's head, it's out.
That's the thing about the afterlife. It doesn't require the internet. It doesn't require malicious actors. It just requires somebody to make a copy and forget about it.
I didn't forget about it. I just never got rid of it. There's a difference.
Is there?
Maybe not. Either way, the data's still there. 900 names in a box, and a tape somewhere else with the same 900 names. Two copies at least. Maybe more.
That's the answer to Daniel's question. How many people are holding that data? You can't know. Because some of them are holding it without meaning to. Some of them are holding it and don't remember. Some of them are holding it and it's in a landfill.
Or in a box in my flat.
If the chain of custody is unknowable, what does remediation even mean? Is the best we can do to treat the data as permanently compromised and move on?
I think that's the best we can do. Not because it's satisfying, but because it's honest. The data is out. The copies are uncountable. The only thing you can change is your own exposure.
The pipeline isn't going away. The automation gets faster. The repackaging gets more sophisticated. The physical copies keep accumulating. The afterlife of a breach dataset is going to get longer, not shorter.
The practical response stays the same. Know what was breached. Change what you can. Assume the old credentials are burned forever. That's the actionable part. Not retrieving the data, which you can't do anyway. Just knowing it's out there and acting accordingly.
That's the strange comfort in all of this. You don't need the data to protect yourself from it. You just need to know it exists. The knowledge is enough.
That's what services like Dehashed are actually selling. Not the data. The knowledge. The signal that says this credential is burned, do something about it.
The misconception people have is that changing a password or deleting an account makes the breach data go away. It doesn't. The data set lives its own life. The only thing you can do is make the data useless.
That's a real thing. A changed password is a dead credential. It's still in the combo list, still circulating, but it doesn't open anything anymore. That's the win. Not destroying the data, which is impossible. Devaluing it.
If you found this useful, a review helps other people find the show. Thanks for listening.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, who apparently has been sitting on 900 names for 3 decades.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Email us at show@myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from law. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.